you say tomata. I say tomato, you say de Palma. I say de Palma, de Palma,
de Palma,
de Palma,
de Palma.
Let's call the whole thing off. Let's not call the whole thing off, because hey guys, we've got a show to do. We're talking de Palma, the optic nerds. Hello and welcome to the Optic Nerds podcast. We are back, and this week, as I have already mentioned in the rather musical introduction there, we're going to be talking about Brian De Palma. Now, the reason we're doing this is because the film Scarface celebrates its 30th anniversary this year. So I thought, well, what better time to look back on Brian De Palma's career as a whole? Well, not actually looking at Scarface, but...
That's all right, yeah.
But I did want to talk about...
It is a terribly scarred face.
I haven't introduced you yet, so silence.
Just voices in the ether.
I did want to talk about Scarface, but I can't talk about it on my own. Hey, there's two guys here looking like they want to say something, so I better introduce them to you. First of all, we got Peter Auger on my left.
Hello.
Mark Finch on my right.
Hello.
And guys, we're talking the big kahuna of the modern thriller. Supposedly, that's what I myself have labelled him.
I thought you were going to say Hitchcock. Hitchcock called him the big kahuna.
He's been known for that for the last 2 minutes.
Or is he? very exciting and a huge oeuvre to inform our discussion, of course. But I thought before we just have a quick chat about Scarface, I thought the best way to approach this would be to choose three films that are kind of part of a style, if you like, because he's done war films, he's done gangster films, and of course he's done horrors and thrillers. So I thought, well, let's take three thrillers from various stages of his career and see what we come up with, see what magic we can weave. But first of all, Scarface, yeah, 30 years old this year. Mark, I know you're a big fan of Scarface. No, you're not, are
no,
you?
No, no, no.
Let me record that again.
No, leave it in.
It just shows how organic this whole thing is. Let's call the whole thing off.
Oh, I can lie? Yes.
So, Mark, you're not a fan of Scarface at all, are you?
Again, that's wrong. I'm really.
Why did you say Mark would really want to talk about Scarface?
No, I do.
I said Mark has got a lot to say about Scarface.
Why? If you're not a big fan or you don't mind it, or you hate it.
I don't hate it. I don't think it's wonderful. I think it's incredibly overrated, but it is watchable.
Okay, we're getting ahead of ourselves. So, okay. In terms of the. Because you talk about Scarface, you talk about The Godfather. Goodfellas, anybody who likes gangster films and has liked what the gangster films that have been released over the last kind of 30 years or so, well, going back even further when we look at The Godfather, these are the films that always crop up as being the classics of the genre. And so where do you think Scarface sits amongst those sort of films? Mark, I will come to you first, as someone who really doesn't care one way or the other about this film.
Where do I think it sits?
Yes.
Amongst the pantheon of good gangster films.
Pantheon? Did you say that? Or did I say it first?
I'm not sure.
That's a great word.
It came from somewhere, so I assume from you. It
came from the pantheon.
Or the dictionary.
Yeah.
Maybe in the dictionary. I think it's okay. It's not... it somehow got made a classic, and I'm not entirely sure why. Maybe Al Pacino's performance, but I always found it really over the top. De Palma's direction is wonderful, as it is normally, but other than that, I can't really find much, anything that makes it really stand out from anything else. Yeah, it's violent, and it got into a bit of trouble because of that. It's got, at the time, it had the most swear words of any movie ever released at that time, thanks to Oliver Stone's script. I think the word fuck gets used more in that film than any other film, and it's like 180 or 200 times. And the TV version with all the swearing dubbed over it is hilarious. Anyway,
I've got some sympathy with what you say there about you can't quite understand how it has attained this status, especially compared to, you think of the quality of things like The Godfather and Goodfellas, and it's not on that level by any stretch of the imagination.
And other De Palma films, you know, this isn't even one of his best films.
But I read something the other day which is very informative when you look at De Palma films in general. And I can't remember what the review was in relation to or even who said it, but it was that it takes three great scenes and no bad ones to make a great movie. And I think that's what De Palma pulls off a lot of the time, and he certainly pulls it off in Scarface.
Even Michelle Pfeiffer's dancing.
Especially Michelle Pfeiffer's dancing.
Because that was a terrible scene.
His ability to deliver on a set piece is almost second to none, especially at his best. And I think maybe that's, you know, when you think of Scarface, you think of the balcony scene, don't you? You think of
and the train sword scene, to be fair, there is a wonderful scene in the film, really ramps up the tension, and it's very well executed. It's the assassination attempt while he's in, Tony's in the sort of restaurant bar, whatever it is, nightclub, with the stand-up comedians on the stage, and that scene's great. You know, that is great. But that's, I think, more down to De Palma's direction than acting ability or anything else. I think that's the one thing De Palma can do. I mean, he can take a scene which I mean, I've not read the original script, but it could have just been two lines of the script, and he can really sort of execute tension so well. He can really sort of bring it out just from camera work and editing. So it's an interesting film to watch. From a filmmaking point of view, it's very good because you get to learn tricks of camera tricks and use of different lenses and lighting techniques, and you get to watch Tony try and fuck his sister, and it's interesting, but there's something about, he's such an unlikable character that when he dies at the end, I breathe a sigh of relief. There's no likable characters in the film.
Certainly no Don Vito Corleone.
Exactly.
Pete, you remember what we were talking about?
It's nothing like as good as the other films you're referencing, like Godfather and certainly not The Godfather.
Goodfellas,
yeah, but it's a very different type of film, I think, in that similarity to Godfather is kind of the rags to riches from how, you know, the Corleone family built themselves up, especially in Godfather 2 with the backstory. But within Scarface, you've got, which I quite like, is the rags to riches, you know, how he's gone from, you know, the Cuban immigrant to major drug lord, and how he went about doing that. And I quite like the excess. I quite enjoy the excess in it, be it the violence or his over the top actions, and, you know, the mounds of coke.
Oh, he just sort of buries his face in it.
I mean, it's excessive, but, you know, it kind of works. I think the only reason maybe it sort of hit the consciousness like it did recently as well, maybe since sort of the 90s, is because the hip-hop kind of community took it under their wing and made it one of their kind of flagship films. It seemed to be that loads of kind of gangster rap referenced Scarface shitloads, and it kind of hit the public consciousness. I know it was well known before, but what I mean is suddenly sort of teenagers of the 90s and just suddenly picked it up as something they really, really loved because the artists they love were watching it.
But also, scarily, if you listen to a lot of the music and everything, it seems to be that they want to emulate Tony Montana.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's absolutely.
Which
yeah.
is, which is, you know, I mean, this horrible
is,
idea.
This is rightly or wrongly. I'm
stay
saying
in school, kids.
Yeah, be cool.
Yeah, be cool. Stay in school.
But yeah, rightly or wrongly, you emulate the character. But I think that's why, again, it's become very, very popular again. Certainly in the 90s, it's sort of picked up because loads of songs were referencing it and using samples from it and things like that.
Well, it caused a bit of a thing in the UK as well because it was banned for a while, wasn't it? And then it was cut. Yeah. And then it finally got a video release for the first time in years back in the 90s. I remember because, yeah. you know, that's when I first saw the film. So it's always been in the public, certainly in my consciousness, it's always been that film.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, did you see that scene where the guy gets, you know, torn apart by the chainsaw, which you don't really see?
No, just but his
it's
eyes.
Yeah. It's actually, that's a very well done scene.
Extremely well done. But like you say, in the back of it, you've got a really just a very, very technically brilliant director. And it's not my favourite De Palma film by any stretch, but I definitely like it more than Mark does. I randomly as well saw, well, if you believe the cab driver I was in the cab with, he pointed out there's an island off Miami called Star Island, which apparently the house, he sort of said, see that house? That's the house from Scarface. So I was like, oh, really? And I looked at it and thought, well, it definitely is the same kind of house, you know, with the balconies out front and stuff. But I need to go back and check it out. But sort of seeing that made me think, oh, blimey, okay. I'll have to... I have to see if that's the case, and it kind of made me think, oh, cool, we're about to talk about Scarface, and I've just seen the house.
It came at an interesting time, just as the last thing I want to say, but it came at an interesting time in Pacino's career, really, because he was in the midst of a series of kind of flops at this time, and his career didn't really pick up until about 5 years later.
Sea of Love was the film that brought him back. Yeah.
That's right, yeah. I don't know what my point is, really.
Was this in his cruising period?
But yeah, no, it was just after that.
His revolution period.
But I suppose my point is that despite how well it's regarded now, and how, you know, it was a fairly major release at the time as well, and did okay, that it didn't seem to do much for Pacino.
No.
At the time, you know,
and yet people still say that's one of his best performances, disagree with, but people do rate it very highly.
But I guess that happens a lot, doesn't it? You know, people reflect and retrospectively a film will become one of the actor's best or one of the director's best. I mean, off the top of my head, I can't, you know, I wish I could just pluck an example out of my head, but it does seem to happen. Well, I guess the biggest classic example would be, you know, Citizen Kane, but... that does tend to happen, doesn't it? People just look back and realise, wait a minute, that was a fantastic performance.
Enough!
Okay, but yeah, I like it. What about you?
Well, I think I'd go along with a lot of what Mark said. I was surprised when I watched it in early 90s, I think it was, for the first time, and how dated it seemed. Because it is a very 80s film, and maybe the 80s just dates, you know, the expiry date on an 80s movie is much shorter than any other decade, perhaps. I don't know. I've thought that with a lot of films from the 80s that I've seen since.
I don't think the... just plucking a random film out of my head from the 80s, but The Lost Boys, I don't think that's dated particularly badly. I mean,
No, it's still recognisably an 80s film.
No, that was me kidding. That's probably the most 80s film in existence.
Remember
the,
that?
The most 80s
just
film
when he pulled
in existence.
Me in and just when I thought I was out.
Was it the greased up guy? The greased up dude with a saxophone and his tight pants.
All right, I've had enough. You're going off into areas that I do not wish to follow you.
Okay.
So let's talk about sisters. Never were there such devoted. Sisters.
At least you didn't go, sisters,
Is this becoming sort of like the De Palma musical episode?
Yeah, we're
in a very singing mood.
Sorry, I'm going to stop now, because I can't sing, so it's torture for everyone.
So Sisters is a 1973 film starring Margot Kidder, Jennifer Saltz, is it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Jennifer Saltz.
And Charles Durning. And this is about... Margot Kidder plays a young... French Canadian, is she?
French Canadian, yeah.
Model, and she's she meets a young advertising rep on a movie.
That really sorry, came through on the mic. The postman just rang, by the way, guys.
Yeah, on a television show rather, and she takes him back to her apartment where he is brutally murdered by. I've just remembered we should probably say that there are spoilers throughout this podcast because we can't really talk about any of these films without without giving away major plot details. Although that happens early on in this film, so he's murdered. Supposedly, we think by her insane twin sister, who was a Siamese twin. They were separated, and the murder is witnessed by a neighbor, and the police don't believe her. So she investigates the murder herself with the help of a private dick. So I'll come to Pete on this one. What was your opinion of Sisters?
It was up and down as the film was going along, I have to say. I very much sort of bought into Margot Kidder's performance, accent slightly aside. It sort of delved into Eastern European areas, it seemed at times. But I quite like where they were going initially with the initial sort of flirtation with the chap that she met on the television show and going back to the apartment.
Straight away at the outset there, you've got a major preoccupation of De Palma with the you're watching something that initially you're being led to believe is something that it isn't.
Yeah.
You're watching a TV show and you don't know you are originally.
Yeah.
And it pulls out and you realise it's something else. He does that a lot at the outset of his films.
A classic pullback, yeah. But once this young chap meets his sad demise, there's a very, very strange scene where the neighbour has kind of witnessed the murder and wants to get the police there as quickly as possible, while in the meantime, Margot Kidder and this strange doctor figure, who then turns up at the door to help her out.
It's her ex-husband.
Her ex-husband, and is it? I mean, forgive me, I forget. He's kind of a surgeon, but he's also like a psychiatrist.
It's strange.
Sort of a doctor of many fields, it would be. But they're trying to dispose of this body, and it's kind of a race against time. And it's kind of plays a bit like a comedy, like a Laurel and Hardy sketch, because he like slips in the blood, and and the police are coming up the stairs,
and she's got the outrageous French accent, yeah.
And I don't know, it just and to me this film kind of flitted between genres, it kind of jarred a little bit throughout the film, And you've kind of got classic thriller aspects. You kind of have this kind of weird slapstick comedy kind of moments. You have a lot of then towards the end, a lot of psychedelic type.
Yeah, it gets really trippy.
Very trippy later on. So it's a bit of a mashup, which it actually quite appeals to me. But I would say that it's not a film that's really grabbed me immensely. I just quite enjoyed the ride while I was on it.
What did you make of the ending?
The ending confused me slightly, I have to be honest. So I'm going to hear what you guys thought about it first.
Over to you, Mark.
I agree with a lot of what Pete says. I just found it way too predictable, I think. And frustrating. I find it, you know, of course she witnesses the murder, so she goes to the police. They don't believe her, so she has to go out and prove the murder herself, and she just seems to get deeper and deeper into it. And you know, she goes to the hospital or the home where Margot Kidder's character has, you know, her and her sister have come from, and the doctor convinces her, or convinces everyone else there, that she is actually one of the patients, and and gets them to, you know, subdue her and put her, lock her in a room, and then they drug her, and it's just like, oh, for God's sake!
Moment there where she goes into the hospital and she encounters that patient who has got a phobia
Of dirt. Obsessive compulsive.
She just suddenly starts screaming about somebody phoning, doesn't she? What is it?
You can catch germs through the phone.
Oh, catch germs through the phone. Yeah.
That was great, and I wish she'd been a more prominent character. She's in that one scene for like 2 minutes.
That's kind of one of those moments where he pushes it to a point where you'll either, as we'll talk about later, laugh, or you'll be kind of a little bit unnerved and a bit chilled by it. But sorry, I interrupted you there. No,
that's all right. I just found it more frustrating than anything. I thought it was well acted. I really like Jennifer Salt in this, and she looks. I don't know if you guys know Holly Marie Coombs, but she spitting image of her
from Charmed.
From Charmed, yeah, spitting image.
I hadn't really made the connection.
Okay. Well, anyway, that aside, I was really enjoying it up until the murder, and then as soon as the journalist starts delving into the whole. Investigation. I just lost my interest because I just found it way too frustrating. And
this is what kind of got me initially after the murder. But I think I need to watch it again. I watched it for the first time, and it's you watch anything for the first time, and you're just trying to follow the thread of the plot more than anything. Mm. And maybe look at some of the more technical aspects. But she turns up with the police and goes poking around in the flat with the police and. So just sit down with a potential murderer while we go and have a look around.
Yeah, it's the worst police investigation.
It's just so. I mean, I was laughing, but I just.
Yeah.
I mean, Brian De Palma, I kind of refuse to believe sometimes that he must know that it's ludicrous, and he's just kind of playing about with us. I mean, I don't know.
Is this one of his? This is one of the ones he wrote, right? Because this is one of his scripts.
Yeah, I think he co-wrote it. He did script it. Let me just look for you. But the that scene where initially when the neighbour gets interested in this because we know she sees the man dying at the window because there's that moment where he does the...
He tries to write help, doesn't he?
In blood. And De Palma does the juxtaposition of the two shots. What's it called, that technique?
I can't remember.
Split screen.
Oh, the split screen. Sorry. Oh, I see what you mean. Right, yeah. Yeah, he uses that a lot in his early films, doesn't he?
A blanket. Yeah. And so we know she sees that. That's fine. But then she goes over there and she says that she witnessed the murder by the woman, and she didn't. And we know she didn't because we know she couldn't. When we meet her, all she's seeing is the guy dying. So she didn't witness who did it, but she's adamant that she did.
Yeah.
And that's kind of just a kind of detail that propels the plot forward.
Yeah.
Without really taking the trouble to deal with what we know to be true, and he kind of is guilty of that from time to time.
It's a very good point.
Yeah,
that
is good.
That scene with the police in the flat, and then when she hires the private detective, and he's in the flat while she's in her flat. Again, I mean, not exactly Laurel and Hardy, but you're kind of expecting sort of type background music because he's kind of bumbling about, and comes out to the window to make sure everything's okay.
I love it when he sort of manages to get out of the building and then just sort of walks out the door and then sprints for the van.
He just runs for it.
It's like he's been like really careful up until that point, and then it's like he might as well just be running down the street waving his arms, going, "Look at me, look at me."
So I think that's
the point.
His style is very kind of old-fashioned in that sense because he directs actors sometimes in the same way that you would they behave or act in a way that is has a lot in common with kind of 50s thrillers. There's that kind of slightly OTT aspect of the performance and the way the gestures are just slightly larger and that moment where he's in the flat poking around and they're coming in the front and he's gesturing through the window and stuff is a prime example of that.
Yeah.
I don't really mind it. I think, but it can just take you out of the moment. And this is a good example of a De Palma film where you can be going along with it so far, and then you're like, what's going on there?
It's the jarring nature of, if you're going to sort of mix and match your filmmaking styles between thriller and comedy and whatever. He doesn't do it as adeptly as he has in other films. The thing I found confusing, particularly about the ending though, was I'm sort of trying to recall it now, is the sort of you have the journalist who then gets committed essentially to this hospital, gets brainwashed into thinking she didn't do the murder, then kind of gets brainwashed into thinking she is the conjoined twin. Am I reading that right?
No, I think she's just seeing. I think she's
just, there's this crazy dream.
I think she's just seeing what happened.
I thought that's
from
what it was going to end up.
That's nice. What I thought.
That was going to be how it turned out.
Yeah, I did as well. And that kind of pulled me out of it.
And then it took a completely different direction with the actual ending and the eventual demise of the doctor / ex-husband.
It was written with a lady called Louisa Rose, who never wrote anything, hasn't written anything since, and never wrote anything before this. So.
Really? It's a mate of his or something.
Nothing else.
Yeah, maybe.
That's strange.
I do like the bookend. I like, because I know De Palma does it with a lot of these films. The bookending of the film. Yeah, the film starts with us watching the victim, and then it ends with him again being watched. Yeah.
He's often, I don't know if you'd say accused of kind of emulating or aping Hitchcock's films. He's clearly influenced by him, and as with a lot of his early films and even some of the 80s films, you've got real kind of Hitchcock aspects to this film. The scores by Bernard Herrmann.
Yeah.
So it sounds like a Hitchcock film. And you've even got you've even got events in there that are kind of lifted from a Hitchcock movie, in this case, Rope. Remember the...
Oh, the body in the sofa.
So, I mean, he says he doesn't reference. I'm sure that I think that I'd read something where he said, I don't reference, but I think that...
Not convinced that would, on that one.
That would depend
really?
On your interpretation of what referencing is, wouldn't it?
Do you mean reference Hitchcock or just reference anything else?
Anyone.
Because I'm pretty sure the pram falling down the steps of the Untouchables is a direct reference to Battleship Potemkin.
Specific, almost.
Yeah.
So anyway, Sisters, would you recommend it, Mark?
That's a difficult one. I would say, if someone said, should I watch this film? I would always say yes, because their opinion could differ greatly. And Sisters is kind of regarded by De Palma fans as a classic. I struggled with it.
I will give it another go. So it's not really a recommendation as much as, probably needs, like with a lot of his things, needs a second viewing. I don't think it revealed everything to me in the first sitting, so a bit like Mark, it's difficult for me to say heartily recommend it, thumbs up, but it certainly intrigued me enough to maybe give it another go.
I'm the same, really. I enjoyed it up to a point. The ending I thought was a little bit silly, given that the detective's up the telegraph pole or whatever with his binoculars looking at something which is like 20 foot away.
Yeah, yes. I know.
And looking about as conspicuous as a private detective possibly could, and it's just in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
But as a little kind of scene, a little I don't know how you describe, maybe a metaphor, a visual metaphor for the film or some of the themes of the film, it works quite nicely if you take it in that way.
And it's a great shot as well.
You won't be wanting for great shots in most De Palma films.
Yeah, so. Very true.
Okay, so I think that's Sisters for you. So the next De Palma film I'm going to talk about is one of my personal favourites. Gonna start again there. You're just you're looking so cheesily smug about something. I don't know what you are.
Really? I think that's just my I think if I was
that's
a dragon,
that's just your face.
If I was a dragon, I'd be cheesily smug.
Okay. So the next film we're going to talk about is Dressed to Kill, one of my favourite De Palma films. And how to kind of sum this one up? It stars Angie Dickinson, Michael Caine, and Nancy Allen, and we meet Angie Dickinson. She plays this, I think it's fair to say, she's sexually unfulfilled. yes. housewife, we meet her and follow her in her daily life at the beginning, and she's got a therapist played by Michael Caine who she unloads on.
Is that fair to say? Any word is going to sound like sexual innuendo when talking about
when we talk about Jessica Kirby.
She does what you do with a therapist. She tells him her problems, and her main problems are that she's sexually frustrated. So she meets this is followed by a sequence in a museum or an art gallery, a bravura sequence, I think is the word you would use, and she meets this man, has dirty sex with him in the back of a cab, goes back to his place, and shortly after this is, well, we said spoilers, we can't really talk about this any further without saying what happens next. She's brutally murdered in an elevator, and this is witnessed by a prostitute with a heart of gold played by Nancy Allen, and from this point on Nancy Allen is trying to track down is initially suspected of the murder, and yeah. then is trying to track down the killer, and is being tracked by the killer herself, and she gets involved with Michael Caine,
and she kind of enlists the help of the son
of Angie Dickinson. Yeah. So I think that's about as far as we'll go in explaining the plot.
Yes, about 20 minutes left.
But it's only when you start trying to outline what it's about that you realise, well, how far can you go without giving anything away? It's about a sexually frustrated housewife, initially. And you can't say anything more than that, you know, without giving the game away. So,
well, if you read the back of the DVD cover, it's actually very misleading.
Is it?
Yeah, because it makes it sound like a... pass it over. It's
a jolly romp, does it?
Not even a jolly romp. It's
I use the word romp a lot.
This taut psychosexual chiller is a razor sharp tale of passion, madness, and murder that's as scary as the devil with suspense to spare. Fashionable Manhattan therapist Dr. Robert Elliott faces the most terrifying moments of his life when a psychotic killer begins attacking the women in his life with a straight razor stolen from his office. Desperate to find the murderer before anyone else is hurt, Elliot is soon drawn into a dark and disturbing world of chilling desires, and as the doctor edges closer to the terrible truth, he finds himself lost in a provocative and deadly maze of obsession, deviance, and deceit, where the most harmless erotic fantasies can become the most deadly sexual nightmares.
Gosh, so that makes it sound like the Michael Caine character is the one who's kind of driving the plot forward.
Well, he's the main character.
He kind of isn't, is he?
No, not at all.
This is a classic example of, bullshit.
I think that really missells the film.
I think whenever this DVD was released, I guess it would have been sort of mid-2000s, presumably. At that point, Michael Caine is the biggest star in the film.
Yeah. 2004.
And his name is top left, which is top billing.
Yeah.
And they're trying to make it about him.
Yeah. But also maybe as well they're trying to give away as little as possible. So it does a fair job of that.
I'm not going to give them that
credit.
It
doesn't give much away, but it's
it tells you the wrong plot though.
But it does tell you the wrong plot.
Well, I think it's fair to say if you give someone the wrong plot, then you're not giving much of the real plot away, are you?
No, that's true. What it should have said was that this film is about a talking giraffe. caught up in a deadly web of deceit and terror.
Web of deceit spun by spiders from Hades.
So what did you think of it, Mark?
I'd never seen Dress to Kill, and for some reason I thought I had, but it turned out I hadn't.
Now this interests me because neither of you had seen this film prior to us doing it, and so as someone who had seen it and was familiar with it, very familiar with it, and knew precisely what to expect, and couldn't recall their reaction first time they saw it or whether they twigged what was really happening, I'm very interested to hear your reaction as a first time viewer. To the film.
I absolutely love this film. It's so sleazy, but it's De Palma somehow gets away with it. It uses that kind of 80s soft focus lens porn look, and it kind of drips with.
It looks like Emmanuel in the first.
Yeah, it's kind of just drips with bodily fluids, if you like, and it's but it's. So well acted and very, very well written, and I'll be honest with you, I really got into the characters, and the first 20 minutes, I mean, we've already, you've already given away quite a major plot twist there, where De Palma pulls a psycho, if you like, and kills off what you think is the main
character.
This is his psycho. Yeah, exactly. And I know you're going to talk about the themes of that later, but he got me. I had no idea that was going to happen. Yeah,
really.
There's another twist coming up, which I'm sure we'll talk about. And again, I'll let you give that one away, Phil. Which I was beginning to be, you know, suspectful of.
Yeah.
But Angie Dixon getting killed like that, absolutely no way. So when
How did you react to that?
I was shocked. I was genuinely shocked. The elevator. I mean, it's a brutal death anyway. Yeah. The elevator doors open, and you know the hand come up. The black gloved hand with a straight razor in it, and she holds up her hands to protect herself, and it just slices, you know, right through the palm of her hand, which automatically makes everyone who's ever cut their hand there go, because it stings like a son of a bitch. We all know how much that fucking hurts. And then, you know, so she's getting hacked away in the elevator. The door's open. Nancy Allen's there seeing it. And you think, maybe she can be saved, but the killer's in there. So how is this going to work? And of course, you know, the doors close. Nancy Allen nearly gets attacked, but just manages to. And that's a great scene as well, because that's all done slow motion and really good editing. And then, of course, Angie Dixon dies. And I was shocked. And I felt a little bit pissed off that the rug had been pulled, that I'd been tricked so well.
Yeah.
And that just made me love the film even more, because I thought, well, he did it. You know, that's great. And. And then we follow, you know, Nancy Allen and Angie Dickinson's son, who I can't remember his name. He's a director now, but he played Arnie in Christine. John
yes,
Compton's Christine.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. And he's also in what's the other 80s biggie that he's in? Oh no, he's in isn't he in Jaws
2? He's in Jaws 2. Yeah, he's in Jaws 2 as well. In fact, I think that was one of his first.
Was it?
One of his first films, I think. Yeah, because Jaws 2 would have been a couple of years before this. But
was Jaws 2 in the 80s, in the 70s?
79,
oh, right,
I think.
Okay. Yeah.
I think. Jaws 3, oh, I'm not sure. I could be very wrong on that.
Not this,
yeah, it doesn't really matter.
By a big fish.
But no, absolutely fantastic. So much, so many red herrings. And, you know, the whole sequence where she wakes up and feels, you know, the morning after having had, like you say, dirty sex with this man that she's just met. And she's going through his, because she goes through his drawer. I can't remember why. Oh, she's trying to write him a note, isn't she? And she's going through his drawer to find a pen.
She enjoyed it,
And she finds a letter from his doctor saying that he's got, is it syphilis?
Some kind of STD.
And you know, she freaks out about that. And all I'm thinking is, oh God, you know, she's got to get home. He's going to want to have sex with her at some point.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's not going to be able to. And I'm trying to think in my mind, unfolding how the drama of that's going on.
That's interesting because, as I say, I've seen it before. And that bit of the film always kind of leaves a bit of a nasty aftertaste for unfortunate use of terminology, really. But because I know he's accused of misogyny but in some quarters. And for me, that's got a bit of a misogynistic note to it, that this woman who is cheating on her husband and does so with a stranger in such a kind of dirty, girly way, and then she kind of finds out, she's humiliated by the finding out that the guy's got a sexually transmitted disease when she's leaving him this note, and the romance is shattered and the fantasy is shattered in that instant. But your reaction there, for you, that worked because you're not seeing it as her being humiliated, because you don't know she's going to die. Yeah. What you see is, what are the implications dramatically now for her when she goes home? Mm. So that gives you I'll reconsider my point on that one.
Your sympathies do kind of lie with her a little bit, because her husband's such a pig.
Mm.
You know, dream sequence aside at the beginning, and again, the film is bookended with these two dream sequences set in a shower. Mm. Dream sequence aside, you know, she wakes up in the morning and he's having sex with her, completely unfulfilling sex for her. And it's the way, as he climbs off her, and he does climb off her, he kind of pats her face in a really patronising sort of like, well done, sort of way. And then just goes and has a shower, and she's just lying there, and it's horrible. And so you just... Yeah, I can understand why people say, you know, the misogyny in it, but I think you are meant to sympathise with her. And I kind of did. Because she's obviously a loving mother. You know, there's the scene with her son and she's really supportive mm-hmm. for what he's doing. Yeah. So you are meant to. I think you really are meant to sympathise yeah. with her.
Yeah. And I think the scene in the art gallery where she's obviously not sure about this. She wants to pursue this fantasy, and this man is the focus of that, who she's seen in there. But she's obviously very, very nervous, and even at the point where she goes to the taxi when he's outside, and she's still kind of pretending that this is all a coincidence, and because she wants to get to know him, and he just pulls her in, and within minutes, seconds, her underwear's off, and they're indulging in very, very hot, steamy. I hope the cab driver got a tip.
Oh, I'm sure he did.
he got a few tips.
But you know that her moans of ecstasy in the back of the cab were actually dubbed. It was a different actress doing
Well, it was a different actress in the shower as well. It wasn't Angie Dickinson at the beginning.
Or the body double for that.
Well, apparently that caused controversy. It's like, but Angie Dickinson was pushing 50. I mean, I'm not a doctor, but
that wasn't the body of a 50.
If anyone was fooled and thought that was Angie Dickinson, then they're idiots.
Let's not get too bogged down in breasts and
No, I know.
Botox.
The only reason I say that is because I read up on the film, and apparently that caused a bit of a stir.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, well, was anyone convinced it was Angie Dickinson?
Well, she was.
But why would you be upset by the fact that they'd used it? I mean, where's the offence there? Is it offensive to her? Is it offensive to you as a viewer because you believed it was? What's the issue?
I think it was just Angie Dickinson was a very big TV star at the time. I can't remember what the program was. There was a cop show in America that
Policewoman.
Is that what it was? Policewoman. Yeah. And you know, she was a big TV star, and I think people were just a bit shocked that she was doing something that to them was maybe borderline porn. Mm. Like, I think it was more that than the fact that was her body. I think it was how could she be in something like this?
And regarding the ending and what happens, I love the fact that you were kind of hoodwinked throughout this, and I think that's one of the reasons I love it, because it's one of those films that's just such a great ride, you know, and nothing is as it seems in this film, and it's done with such style and again excess as well. But if you're inclined to like this kind of thing, you're gonna love this.
I agree.
And but I'm maybe surprised that you didn't for a minute suspect the character who it turned out to be.
Oh no, I did. That's what I was saying. The where it pulled the rug up from under me was Angie Dickinson's character. But about halfway through the film, I did start to suspect.
Sorry, at the outset, when you first saw this character, you didn't think, oh, that's so and so.
I thought, I can't remember exactly where I thought it,
because I just see it so. It's to me, it's just so clear now.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. There was a couple of. See, I'd read the back of the DVD cover, which did throw me off completely.
So it did its job,
but it also gave me a complete... Because when I read the back of the cover, I thought, oh, God, this is going to be some awful... You know, it's going to be terrible. And, you know, if I wouldn't have picked it up to rent or buy or anything if it hadn't already been recommended to me. So, I'm not sure it did do its job in that respect. Mm. But I did start to think, well, because it... I do the wrong thing. I look at a film or a TV show like Bones or all those sort of things and look at the characters and the way that it's all edited and, you know, and I think, okay, so if I was writing this and making this, and if I made that person the killer, and then you look for the beats, you look for what they say and what they do and how often they appear in the film and what other characters there are. So if it is him, then... Okay, that makes sense, and that makes sense. And the fact that they filmed that particular, you know, there's a scene where they spy on this doorway where they know the killer comes in and out of, and you see the killer leave, but you never see the killer enter. And that I thought, okay, so that could, you know.
But if you are starting to suspect him, De Palma throws you off the scent with a kind of chase scene very cleverly. About two-thirds of the way through the film.
Yeah, and that's the bit that threw me. And so that, I mean, I don't know if...
think that's a bit of... It's very contrived, actually, but it does its
job. It works, and it's skillfully done. Also has the most annoying cop Even more annoying than the cops in Sisters.
He doesn't have a great deal of respect for police work.
No, not really. You know, Nancy Allen's like, you know, scared for her life, and this cop's just kind of like just blowing it off. You know, it's just like, well, whatever.
Okay, Pete, what did you make of Dressed to Kill?
I didn't like it as much as you two. I wasn't into the but was fooled in exactly the same places. Psycho is exactly right. Basically, you think it's going to be about Andy Dickinson's character and what's going to happen to her and the drama that's going to follow her affair. And you know, you got to take your hats off to the kind of the flirtation scene.
I only wear one hat
with
at any one time.
with your respective hats. Just because there's no dialogue, but it's just like one of the most effective flirtation sort of scenes. And has been used again and again in a dozen kind of shop floor
brilliant.
Type
it,
scenes.
It's brilliant.
Really good. I didn't love it as much as you guys do, but what I did enjoy was just the ride of it enjoying being what it is. So it just takes so many classic thriller.
One of the most artfully constructed sentences I think we have ever had on Optic Nerds. That one.
Put your hat back on so you can take it off again. Or just take your socks off. Whatever you.
What I mean by that is that it seems to just indulge in being a thriller. And taking those kind of Hitchcockian conventions and putting them into what is, like you said, Mark, essentially a sleazy erotic thriller. But it makes it elevates it from that just by virtue of the style and what he does with the scenes. And that stuff I really enjoyed. After Angie Dickinson gets meets her rather nasty demise, and you're following different characters, it then becomes Nancy Allen is then the stalked one, and you know everything from the scene on the subway to the scene in Michael Caine's office. It is very, very beautifully done and right on the money in terms of what you'd expect out of a thriller. And that's what I enjoyed about it, because the story, I couldn't quite escape the fact that the story was just very, very cheesy and very, very TV, kind of TV movie, what you might see on like Channel 5 at midnight. but the style was unquestionable. So that's kind of my feeling. Just technically loved it, but the story I found a little bit ludicrous at times.
One thing that always occurs to me when something is described as an erotic thriller is that we use that as a label very readily, but has anybody ever watched an erotic thriller that they found erotic? Because most of the time they're not, are they? No, I can't think of anything actually that I've seen that I've found erotic.
Well, I remember when, this is back when I was a student, it's like, I always use Channel 5 as the example. It probably doesn't happen anymore, but when Channel 5 first came on the telly, sort of Friday or Saturday nights, midnight, you'd have this. It would invariably star Shannon Tweed.
There's a name I've not heard in a while.
And it would just be just very, very contrived plot where she plays
an undercover cop who has fuck all the other cops.
Or it would be like a thriller setup, like she's actually the psycho, and she embeds herself in a situation where everyone trusts her, but then she goes on a killing by fucking them all. And then she goes on a killing spree. So I don't want to tar it with that brush. It is definitely smarter than that, but it's just
it's got smarts. I think that's one of the reasons I like it. It's got smarts,
and it, you know what, I can't get away from the fact is that it fooled me completely, like you say. The scene in the elevator with Angie Dickinson was just like, what? And he's like, you fucker, you've done a Psycho on me, I can't believe it. I mean, I was lucky enough to have seen Psycho for the first time when I was very, very young, and I didn't know what was coming. I mean, it sounds ludicrous to say, but when I watched Psycho, I didn't know what was coming.
Yeah.
And you're sort of planning the film out in your head.
I love watching Psycho with people who've never seen it. It's just, that's one of the great treats of, you know, when you watch films anyway, you always enjoy them more if you like the film when you watch them with people who've never seen them before. And it doesn't happen that often that you watch Psycho with someone who's never seen it. But on the few occasions that has happened for me, it's just such a great experience.
And it's you think, how on earth could you have seen Psycho and not know about the shower scene? And I guess I must have in some way. I mean, I was very young when I first saw Psycho. Not stupid young.
Well, because people refer to Mrs. Bates, don't they, a lot? Mrs. Bates in the shower. But and
I just, it was, and yeah, and I did, I thought, fair play.
Yeah.
And that's what I really liked about it. I mean, I know we've not sort of revealed the spoiler yet.
Well, I'm going to say now, and to anybody who hasn't seen the film and wants to enjoy it in the way that Mark certainly did, fast forward 5 minutes, because I'm about to give a huge spoiler. And that is that when we find out that it's Michael Caine, that's the character who is the killer, going back over that, there's a huge plot hole there in that he goes and tells a colleague of his that one of his clients has phoned him and said he's going to start killing again, and he's worried.
Yeah.
Do you remember that scene?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that the colleague who he's telling this to knows full well that Michael Caine is psychologically damaged. So how is he practicing as a psychotherapist then? And how is, why isn't that colleague then kind of alerting the authorities or whatever, you know?
It's a very valid point, actually. I didn't even think of that.
Well, I don't...
But he makes quite a convincing woman, doesn't he? I know he's got, like, shades on and a hat and stuff, but he's... And he's a big, big...
I don't think it's him. I think that didn't they use someone else for... With this, like, the stalking scenes, and I think it's someone else.
I don't know that.
That would be interesting to know, actually, because I'm not convinced they did either. Certainly in the scene after Nancy Allen is back in the room, so to speak.
Oh, at the end, it's definitely Michael Caine. But I think the earlier scenes, I don't think it's just Michael Caine.
Well, it'd be interesting to find out.
It's not like Raising Caine, where it is actually, you know, John Lithgow dressing up as a woman. as Margot.
I actually think it's maybe more feasible than you know, Phil, if you've got a practicing psychiatrist who has their own issues for which they are seeing their own psychiatrist. I think that's...
He's clearly insane.
Yes, but he's supposed to be...
Is that your medical diagnosis?
No, because...
he's supposed to be cured, isn't he?
He's telling his colleague that a client of his, or a patient of his, is phoning him up saying that he's going to kill again, or something like that.
Yeah.
No,
okay.
I know, but...
And the colleague knows that this person doesn't exist. It's an aspect of his own personality.
But then it's that guy that calls the police. That's why the police turn up at the end.
Yeah.
So and he only tells his colleague that.
Well, that's fair enough. But that doesn't explain why Michael Caine's still allowed to practice as a psychotherapist and no one, or a psychologist or whatever he is, and nobody seems to kind of mind that.
I don't know.
Because he's got no end of clients.
Well, he wants patients
coming in and out of his
office. He wants a sex change, doesn't he? That's what he wants, to be a woman.
Yeah.
His split personality is a woman, and that's what he wants. And so I guess he just wasn't, showing any violent behaviour. It's not until... Oh, come on, we're just giving away the complete film here. It's not until Angie Dixon turns up and says that she wants to have sex that he gets turned on by this, and this is why his alternate personality takes over and he kills her, because it's threatening. So, and he doesn't even know, he's not sure what to do at that point. So, I'm not...
Well, this is what I think, quite understandably, the a lot of circles got a bit pissed off about in this film. In that you have someone who wanted the gender reassignment.
It's the same thing with the Silence of the Lambs, wasn't it?
But they were saying it was split personality. So, well, no, gender reassignment isn't split personality. You're not a man and a woman. You're, one in another's body. And there is a long psychological process you have to go through, and a lot of diagnosis and things before they agreed to actually give you an operation. So I think they got a bit miffed. I think a lot of... It's not just transgender, but other, maybe some more liberal circles got a bit miffed that's how it was portrayed.
Well,
which is fair enough.
I mean,
I don't really...
There's a lot of that in cinema, isn't there?
Yeah, but I don't really want to get too bogged down in that, because I just think it's such a... it's an unashamedly in many respects, ludicrous premise, and I think to take it too seriously in that respect, I've always had an issue with that kind of.
Well, I don't take stock with it. That's what happened.
The whole lesbian issue from Basic Instinct, and also something we didn't address when we were reviewing Sisters. They say that basically what they said was that when there are Siamese twins, or you know, conjoined twins. Sorry, apologies for using Siamese twins. When there are conjoined twins, one is inherently evil.
Yeah,
and that's basically what they say. And that you have to give drugs to the evil one to stop.
I know. And, I love it.
I mean, so this isn't, you know,
it's ludicrous that you can't make, say, someone who is transgender. You can't make him a psycho because, you know,
you're saying that they're all psychos.
Yeah, it's like saying it's that just... man's a psycho. So like,
anyway, you were right. It wasn't Michael Caine. It was the lady Susanna Clem who played the policewoman, who was
she played the killer.
Apart from the scene at the end, so in that sense, Brian De Palma again is kind of cheating.
Yeah,
because you're never given the opportunity to guess that might be Michael Caine's character because it's not him. But nonetheless, Brian De Palma has never claimed to be anything less than thoroughly dishonourable when it comes to what the tricks he utilises. You know, he says every second on film is a lie, and that's certainly the case here. But I love it. It's unashamedly thrilling. It does exactly what it sets out to do, and obviously works brilliantly in your case.
Yeah, no, Mark, I loved it.
Well, even worked in your case, even though you didn't like it as much.
Yeah, no, I'd certainly tell people to watch it, although, like you say, depending on anyone who hasn't seen it might not listen to this review, but because we've given so much away. But if people at the beginning of this podcast went away and watched it and came back and listened and see what we think, I'd hope they'd agree that you can't argue with its skill.
Yeah.
Okay, I think that'll do. Dressed to Kill.
Certainly am.
Highly recommended. Next up, Raising Cain. So, Raising Cain, 1992 thriller from Brian De Palma, stars John Lithgow and Lolita Davidovich. And basically, John Lithgow plays a character called Carter Nix.
Yeah.
And he's a child psychologist and starts demonstrating increasingly odd behaviour towards their daughters. Well, his wife's concerned about his concerns regarding their daughter's upbringing. There's a subplot whereby his father, played again by John Lithgow, was responsible for a spate of child kidnappings to do with some research he wanted to carry out on what was it that the father was doing with the kids.
He was studying.
I have terrible trouble seeing what these films are about.
Studying sort of like learned behaviour. So plot spoilers. Yeah, we'll get on plot spoilers. But multiple personality disorders.
Yeah, that's right. And meanwhile, Carter's wife is having an affair with a strapping gentleman fellow. He finds out about it. And over the course of this movie, it becomes apparent that Carter isn't just Carter, but has got a number of personalities, one of whom is the titular Kane of the titular title.
Of a tittle, yes.
So, Pete, who did I come to first last time? I can't remember.
It was me.
I'll come to you first on this one. What did you make of Raising Cain?
Raising Cain. I didn't like it. But I've never liked it. I think I've watched it first when I was about 15, maybe. When it first came out on VHS.
Like 92.
It was released in 92.
Yeah, 92, 93.
And it was sort of around the same time where you had a kind of whole bunch of thrillers, if you like. Probably as a reaction to Fatal Attraction, I suppose. You had a whole bunch of thrillers which were very, very similar. And I think this kind of got lumped in with them, but it may be unfairly because it's not like those sorts of thrillers where you had things like, I don't know, people who you think are normal are actually end up being completely mental killers.
Yeah.
But Raisin Kane takes it, is a bit like that, but it takes it uses a different angle. Which
that's
is
the section, by the way, that I always used to head for in Blockbuster, the people you think are normal but actually turn out to be psycho killers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you think about it. Well, I've got Unlawful Entry, Pacific Heights.
There was a lot of it about Sliver.
Hannah Rocks a Cradle.
Yeah, it was you couldn't move for people you thought were normal but turned out to be psycho killers in the early 90s. <Yeah. laughs>
And the trailer for this.
It's a wonder we will survive.
I remember the trailer for Raising Kane, I remember watching it and thinking, oh, it's going to be a bit like that. And it did kind of surprise me as being something a bit different. Things I like about the film, John Lithgow.
Oh, it just tastes wonderful.
But that's about it.
It's worth watching just for John Lithgow.
Yeah, I mean, powerhouse, as he always is, really. Just a brilliant performance.
But I do find the Kane character a little, especially when he makes his first appearance alongside him in the car. And I do find that it reminds me ever so much of. Do you remember a scene in an episode of Only Fools and Horses where Rodney tries to date this girl and he turns up in a leather jacket and he's smoking a cigarette? It just reminds me so much of Rodney Trotter in that.
He's obviously evil. But what gets me about this film is that it doesn't hang about, right? So basically, the opening scene is Carter getting in a car with a woman he's obviously known for many, many years as their kids played together in the playground. And she's obviously trusts him completely. And within about 3 minutes of a car conversation, he's talking about taking a kid away to be examined in Denmark. Norway.
Yeah.
Oh, Norway.
And it's like, well, how has this never come up before? And then he starts acting all psycho. I was like, well, that doesn't quite ring true.
He's not concerned with the more. I mean, he's broad brushstrokes, isn't he, when it comes to narrative, really?
Yeah, and yeah. Unlike Dressed to Kill, where the style takes over, and I just indulged in the whole the homage to the thriller, if you like. Raising Kane just is too absurd and too cheesy at times. It takes it over the edge for me. I know there is an edge, each of our edges might be in different places, but it tipped it over for me. So some of the contrivances, and we'll talk about it maybe when we get to you guys, but there are some scenes in this which seem to me aren't cheesy erotic thriller, they're American soap opera. And I just couldn't, I just couldn't get on with it.
You're talking about when the wife meets her ex?
Yeah, well, basically, you've got the wife character who everybody said is having an affair on Carter. But the person she's having an affair with is someone, she is a doctor, and she met and fell in love with this man while her wife was getting treated
his
for
wife.
Terminal
his,
cancer.
His wife.
His yeah. wife, sorry, was getting treated for terminal cancer. They end up, their first care, so she meets him, and while his wife is getting treated, she's slowly falls in love with him, and then on New Year's Eve at the strike of 12, she says Happy New Year and goes to give him a little kiss, and they end up having a proper snog.
Yeah.
And then the right next to the wife who's dying in bed, who then turns around for the first time in many, many months and basically sees them at it, and then subsequently dies. And I know it's left open as to whether or not she saw them and that caused the heart failure and all that sort of stuff, but it was just.
She's not. He doesn't set her up as a likable character, does he? With something like that.
She's not. My main criticism of the film is that I'm sympathetic towards her. She's, you know, we follow her throughout the film. So
I was quite glad when
most of the film.
But
Carter is the one you should really. He's the vulnerable one, isn't he? Carter.
He's the victim and the hero, as far as I'm concerned,
and the villain.
Well, not really. No.
Well, the villain inhabits. He's a split personality. So.
Yeah, but
spoiler. Oh no, I gave it away in the.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry about that.
There's no one listening.
But the whole point is you're supposed to see these people as individual characters, and Carter is not a villain. He's weak, definitely weak-willed. He's coerced into it by his father.
What I'm saying
kidnapping
is
kids,
the physical presence that is Carter embodies the villainous presence of Kane. The morally kind of the ambiguous presence of Margot, the victim that is Carter, and Josh as well. Josh really is the is the manifestation of the really vulnerable aspect.
Yes, I disagree with Mark to a point, not completely. I think Carter, you're right, is vulnerable and is the victim, but I also think he is aware of what Kane is doing, and is happy to let Kane take over.
That's what I'm saying. He's weak.
So he's. It's difficult to describe it as heroic if he's happy to let Kane take over and murder people.
Yeah, but that's because he's weak-willed. It's because he's scared. He's terrified of his father.
Yeah, but I'm just saying that I don't disagree with that. What I disagree with is the definition of him being the hero.
Maybe anti-hero then. Mm. Put it this way: I wanted him to
win,
not win. No, I wanted Carter to win. And I felt terribly sorry for him when. For absolutely no reason, you know, he's one minute his wife's in a shop buying him an expensive clock. She's got really shit tasting clocks, by the way. She's buying him an expensive clock, and then this guy turns up that she used to know, and she's fucking him late in that, or trying to fuck him late in that day. So straight away, you think, and you feel sorry for Carter.
But for him to win, that would mean that he got well, wouldn't it? And this film really isn't concerned with Carter getting well, because that's by the by.
No. So I sort of see what you're trying to say, but I just think this the character of the wife, like you say, who ends up kind of being the person I think you're supposed to root for. I couldn't get on with her at all. What's the name of the chap? Manny from Scarface?
Stephen Bauer.
Stephen Bauer.
Who plays the love... Well, he's the love interest, really, isn't he?
It might be the way De Palma directed it, wanted to direct it, but he was straight out of a soap opera. When he opens the clock that the wife gave him, that little 30-second segment of acting is one of the worst things I've ever seen in my life, and films or otherwise. He sort of opens this box and goes,
Or doesn't he sort of kiss it or something?
What's the name of the wife, the character of the wife?
The character?
Yeah.
The character is Jenny Nix.
That's it.
Jenny.
It's like, Jenny.
Really?
So just things like that, just you kind of
it does pull you out.
Pulled out the film.
And this again, we come back to this every time when we're talking about De Palma thrillers, and I think you can look at any of them really, because what else has he done in terms of thrillers? You've got Blowout, you've got
Obsession,
and actually maybe we watched what we watched, but I think Blowout and Obsession are probably guilty of that kind of thing less than the three films that we've discussed so far, because and maybe he's just more disciplined in those films, because Raising Kane is incredibly uneven, and it's got moments that I just think are brilliant. The scene where Carter's been interviewed by the therapist towards the end of the movie.
Oh, that scene's wonderful.
And his performance there is just as he kind of transforms from one as each personality inhabits him, goes from one to the other. He's brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant. And it's kind of it's hypnotic to watch him. You know, especially when Margot settles in for the first. Is that the first time we see Margot?
It is.
Yeah, that's just great.
The film has a centerpiece as well, which you have to doff your cap to. I've taken off hats and doffing caps and all sorts of stuff.
should we quaff a glass later? Yeah. As well?
And that's when you first meet the character of the female therapist who knew Carter's little boy and went with the father.
4.5 minutes.
Four minutes and 15 seconds or something.
Incredible. As they're going downstairs and into lifts. Brilliant.
And it's all dialogue, and then it ends with the reveal of the dead body, which is, on the one hand, brilliant and also really corny, but it's done so well.
I laughed out loud, but in a good way, not in a bad way.
And she blinks as well. If you watch, really? For a split second, her eyes are closed, and then she flings them open.
Because you found that moment and the moment in the hospital when the supposedly dying, well, the actress was only pretending to die, but the moment when the character of the wife who's dying of cancer sees them kiss, or you found that quite shocking, didn't you? You were a little bit kind of
it's the way it's edited, the build up to it, it's actually quite scary.
Yeah,
you know?
I thought so, but you just laughed, didn't you?
Well, it's slow motion and soft focus, and it's just the look of the wife. Isn't she pointing as well?
No, she's just like that.
Yeah, I would have laughed if she'd been
pointing. If it had cut to the bed and it was Donald Sutherland pointing at them, then maybe.
No, I felt really stroke of midnight New Year's Eve. She happens to look at them. I'm sorry. Like I say, just that edge tipped over. But genuinely, though, sorry. Mark's thoughts on the film.
Yes.
I mean, you own it, so I'm assuming you quite
like it. I do like Raising Kane, and I didn't enjoy it as much this time around than I did the first time I watched it. Put it this way, I didn't enjoy the story as much. Like I said, I really found the wife to be actually a relatively ugly character. I don't mean physically. She's actually quite attractive physically, but in terms of her character, she's rather ugly.
Yeah.
And that pulled me out, which is why I started watching the film more from Carter's point of view, and seeing that actually I felt very sympathetic towards Carter, that he's been put in this terrible position where he has to do this to appease his abusive father. And so I started watching it more from that point of view, but also from almost like a film school point of view, where I could really kind of study the long tracking shot, the way it's edited, the way it's filmed, and I enjoyed it a lot more from that angle. So I still really enjoy it, and I still think people should watch this film for that reason. And I think it's the last. I mean, I haven't seen Black Dahlia Murders, so I can't.
I haven't either, actually.
Yeah, so I can't say that. But I think Raising Kane might be the last classic De Palma thriller.
Well, he did a film called Femme Fatale with Antonio Banderas, and I think it was Melanie Griffith.
But that was terrible.
I'm just saying, in terms of his thrillers, this isn't the last of them.
But what I mean is this was the last that I think, if you apply the auteur theory to it, you could watch it and without knowing it was a De Palma film, and point it and say this is a De Palma film, and I didn't get that with Femme Fatale.
He did another film called Passion as well, which I think was his most recent film.
Okay, yeah.
I think that's a thriller, but I'm not sure. I don't know anything about it, so I'm just going on the title.
He sort of went a bit crazy in the 90s, didn't he? He did Mission Impossible and Snake Eyes.
Snake Eyes is interesting. I mean, we'll come back to Raising Kane in a second, but Snake Eyes is, in terms of the setup, the premise, again, you know, you've got, have you seen it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
A long time ago, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a missed opportunity, really, Snake Eyes.
Mm.
He blows it at key moments, but there's a brilliant opening kind of 4 or 5 minutes where we follow Nicolas Cage through this.
It's another tracking shot, isn't it? Yeah,
through this boxing arena. Have you seen it, Pete?
I see Snake Eyes probably about 10 years ago.
Okay.
For once.
Which is brilliant, extraordinary, and again, but it's ruined for me because I'm getting so annoyed by the Nicolas Cage character by this point that I'm not really appreciating the brilliance of what De Palma's doing.
Easy to get annoyed with Nicolas Cage, unfortunately.
In fact, I sometimes get mixed up between Snake Eyes and for some reason, maybe because they were both Nick Cage films that came out at similar times, 9mm.
Oh yeah, 8mm.
8mm, sorry, yeah.
9mm.
Getting film stock mixed up with bullets. Yes.
Credibility or shot gauge. Completely. Or a gauge.
It's funny how even in films where he's not predominantly concerned with the thriller, something like Mission Impossible, which is a kind of action film, really.
Yeah.
He starts Mission Impossible off with something that's kind of similar to the way that we opened a film like Sisters or Raising Kane, where we see something else on a monitor, and then we draw back from that. We see in Mission Impossible a setup, that's being filmed by the Mission Impossible team, you know, yeah. And then we pull back yeah. from that and we see them sat in a room watching watching things unfold. So he kind of gets it into most of his films, really. His war films, Casualties of War and Redacted. Has he made any other war films?
I've seen Casualties of War. I've not seen Redacted. I don't think he's seen any other.
No, I think that's about it. It's less, you know, they're less obviously De Palma films. I think both of those are very good films. And his gangster films as well. I think his gangster films are probably his... With reservations around Scarface aside, I think Carlito's Way and The Untouchables are De Palma at its very best.
I agree. Carlito's Way is one of my favourite films anyway. So, it's...
But back to Raising Kane anyway. I think we got a little
I still enjoy Raising Kane and Stephen Bauer, who surprisingly was, like you say, maybe it was the script or just the direction he was given, or maybe he's just not as good an actor as he was in Scarface, because I quite liked him in Scarface as an actor, and he is fucking dreadful in this, so that's a real shame. So that kind of pulls you out a little bit. And yeah, I just had no sympathy with the wife, and like I said, I didn't want Carter to win. I'm glad that the wife... does show a bit of sympathy towards him she shows that she's sympathetic towards his condition when she learns of it. You know, she sort of, you know, when the psychotherapist is telling them about his childhood, and she kind of realizes this is the way he is, and she's like, oh, that's, you know, it's terrible. I'm glad they threw that in there, because otherwise, then she would have been a 100% pure bitch.
Yeah, no.
As it is, she's only about 90 or 85% pure bitch.
That's
pure
another bitch. Thing. Like that, again, going back to the Hitchcock thing, that you get that in Psycho. You know, a lot of people think it's unnecessary. The psychologist explaining what you've just seen, and that's kind of a neat summation of where we are in the film up to that point with Carter's condition. Yeah. It happens in Dress to Kill at the end. It's another reason why it's so obviously his psycho film, apart from the transvestite killer and the transsexual killer and the lead actress getting killed off at the beginning, that we have this summary at the end, which is probably completely unnecessary, you know? Mm. But with Raising Kane, I mean, I kind of enjoy it for John Lithgow's performance. It gets... I enjoy it from the moment... that the Dr. Waldheim is introduced, and from that point on, I can't, until the end, it's silly and absurd, and how his wife could ever mistake Francis Sternhagen, who plays Dr. Waldheim, for John Lithgow in a wig, or mistake John Lithgow in a wig rather for her is beyond me. You know, she's like 4'11" and John Lithgow is 6'. What? I don't know.
Broad shoulders. He's huge.
So that's ludicrous. But
the other bit that always makes me laugh is the right at the very beginning where he pours chloroform and like knocks out the mum that he's in the car with. The kids are asleep in the back, and then there's the two joggers that are coming behind them in slow motion, and Carter's freaking out because he doesn't know what to do. She's like slumped over, and she sort of he's like pulling her towards him. She slumps and basically headbutts the steering wheel and rests on the horn for a good solid 5 seconds and then pulls her towards him to kiss her. So as they run past, they're like, as they walk past and looking in, they sort of look at each other, go, oh, you know, and carry on running. But basically what they would have seen was this woman headbutt the steering wheel and then sort of like pulled like a ragdoll to be kissed by John Lithgow. And it's just the weirdest. It's the weirdest thing. It's done very well because you are tense and you still really got no idea what's going on at that stage, because this is like 5 minutes in the film, isn't it?
Yeah, you don't. I think basically, and Phil just alluded to it there, there is about 15 minutes of the film which is really bloody good, which is, you know, when the therapist arrives and you've got the tracking shot, and basically all the scenes in the police station, because you've got the interview as well with Kane and Margot and Carter.
Plus the two guys that play the cops are great.
Greg Henry. He's always
how,
been there.
How absurd is it the way that after he delivers this headbutt to the doctor... he just walks out of there, basically. You know, the policeman out again. No respect for the job. Yeah, the policeman's outside the door is asleep.
Yeah.
So, you know.
And the ending, I mean, I'm not sure how far we're going spoilers, but I just thought the ending was just... I just thought it was bad. I just thought the ending was bad.
But it did give us a chance to see John Lithgow in full drag.
Do you mean the face off at the
thriller,
motel?
The classic thriller face off.
Oh yeah, yeah. Again, where he just walks away.
He gets unmolested. That didn't bother me. It was the whole setup of, you know, guy gets stabbed, guy drops baby, he runs, the bullet gun goes off, it shatters the spear, which stops him from getting impaled. But then he catches the child and. Yeah. You know, and it just would have been really funny if the child had just been impaled on the spear, and then it impaled Stephen Bauer.
Because he sets that up, doesn't he? He says, because a guy, when the basically there's a scene where the earlier, just before the conclusion, that there's like a truck with this spear thing sticking out the back, sundial.
And, hey, watch out for that sundial! Hey, as it goes right towards the camera,
he says, "Hey, you're gonna kill someone with that thing." It doesn't do subtlety when it comes to foreshadowing, does it?
You're going to kill somebody with a sundial.
But then that doesn't happen. No. So that was the red herring.
And going back to to his statement that he doesn't think that he does reference it, and he references his own bloody film in this, because when John Lithgow's, when Kane comes, Carter comes back to the house after thinking he's killed his wife, there's someone in there, and he sees some white tennis shoes just round the corner, which is a direct reference to the conclusion, the end of Dressed to Kill.
Yeah.
But I think, I mean, in terms of going back to what you were saying before about the sort of films that this is a part of at the time, it's an interesting time for the thriller, really, because this is following on from... This is following on from Silence of the Lambs was out just before this, about a year before, which set the bar ludicrously high for any thriller in its immediate wake. And I think wisely they decided to try and do something different a lot of these films, because you know, trying to emulate what was achieved in Silence of the Lambs, regardless of what your opinion of it and Anthony Hopkins' performances now, was you're probably onto a loser anyway.
Yeah.
And I mean, but you look at the two films, you look at Raising Cain, 1992, you look at Silence of the Lambs, you know, it really is like a different world. Raising Cain looks so much cheesier, so much kind of, it looks like it was made in the 80s as well. It's acted like it was made in the 80s. It's just, and Silence of the Lambs is adult. It's kind of, it's the performances are note perfect. It's, as a thriller, it is flawless, I think.
But the one thing about Silence of the Lambs, though, is that it's obviously a thriller, but it's kind of serial killer type territory. Kind of a partly kind of police procedural stuff going on in there. Whereas, like, say, Raising Cain, I think, is more, I've said it before, but you have a character you think is trustworthy and kind and ends up becoming a psychotic killer.
No, but that's part of my point. Maybe, I don't know whether it was a conscious thing, but perhaps thrillers veered away from the serial killer.
Yeah.
As a main kind of theme for in the immediate aftermath of Silence of the Lambs, because how could you really compete with that?
Yeah, well,
thoughts.
Well, best
serial killer hot potato catch.
Well, I think
it stabbed me.
My thinking is that those films were more a reaction to the popularity of Fatal Attraction than they were veering away from Silence of the Lambs.
Well, I think Fatal Attraction. Yeah, Fatal Attraction was what, 88, and then you had Sea of Love, which was 89, and then obviously the one that really did it was Basic Instinct, but then that was 92 as well, wasn't it?
So. Yeah, end of 80s, early 90s, they're just that
interesting time for the thriller.
Yeah, I mean, and it was nice to have that kind of diversity, definitely. I mean, thriller.
Oh, I hated Ben's Basic Instinct. I thought it was absolute garbage. I really did.
I quite like it, actually.
No. Sliver, one of the worst.
No, that is terrible.
Basic Instinct had its moments. I'm kind of, I not as bad as you think it is, Phil. But I don't think I liked it.
Yeah, I don't think you liked it as much
either.
As I did.
Not as much as.
No, I really like Basic Instinct. But of course, Body of Evidence.
Ah, well, that's the misunderstood classic.
That's the Magnificent Andersons.
Well, I mean, the body of evidence did finally deliver a film that for all those people who'd ever wanted to see Madonna sit on Willem Dafoe's face, here's the film.
Yeah.
Rent it. Go out and rent it.
This is the thing about all these.
If you want to see Willem Dafoe bugger Madonna,
yeah,
this is the film. And then you had Jade, which was William Friedkin's attempt at entering the genre, penetrating that particular.
I feel we're on the edge of a very interesting discussion here about thrillers in general. So I'm going to stop.
We should review Jade's body of evidence and basic instincts.
Is there anything you'd like to add on Raising Cain, either of you? Anything you've missed that you just simply have to get over?
No, I think I've got everything. I'm referring to notes here, but I think it's out there. It's got a central 15 odd minutes of good stuff, but I think I'll probably happily leave this film alone now for good.
And De Palma himself, as someone who as a part of that kind of era of film and group of filmmakers like Coppola, Lucas, Spielberg, John Milius even as well.
Mm.
You know, he's never De Palma, I think, doesn't have his Taxi Driver or Raging Bull. He doesn't have his E.T. or his Jaws or his Close Encounter. You know, he's never delivered something of that stature. Where do you see him though in relation to those guys? Because he is grouped in with them. Because he kind of came to prominence at the time.
And yeah,
they were friends.
Yeah, yeah,
they've worked on each other's films, haven't they? I mean, yeah. I think De Palma actually wrote the opening scroll for Star Wars, Episode 4.
Oh, okay, no, that I didn't know.
I had no idea about that.
Mm.
Good knowledge. I think, well, where he sits, I think he's more diverse. He's maybe perhaps a bit more in his earlier output, a bit more hit and miss. In the 70s and 80s, but I think probably a good indication is kind of if we each said what our favourite De Palma film is, we'd probably say different films, which kind of probably tells you kind of how I think he doesn't have his E.T. or his Raging Bull, but each of us individually will have what we think is his E.T. and Raging Bull.
I don't think he's made anything, even the stuff that I truly love, I don't think he's made anything that's of the brilliance of those films.
Right,
okay. About, you know, because they are. You know, they're up there. They're amongst the very best films that we've seen in the last 40 years or whatever.
Mm.
I don't think any of his stuff would be.
I don't know. I prefer Carlito's Way to say E.T. I prefer Phantom of the Paradise to Raging Bull.
Wow.
Cool, blimey, Governor.
Because I always found Raging Bull a little bit.
I can't believe you just
overrated.
I can't believe you just inspired a core blimey governor out of me.
Raging Bull's a great film. It's a great, great film, but it's overrated.
Christ Almighty!
Whoa.
We're gonna have to stop there.
Allow me to get. I need a fan piece down here for a second, and a cold flannel cold compress needs to be applied to his forehead.
Phantom of the Paradise, for what it is, for that particular genre.
You had
film,
to get Phantom of the
wonderful.
Paradise in. Didn't
it's
you?
Wonderful.
Look, he's trying to get. As much,
I just fucking love Phantom
he's trying
of the
to
Paradise.
Say as much as he can about Phantom of the Paradise.
Phantom of the Paradise. Phantom of the Paradise. Blah, blah, blah.
That's fine.
No, let's finish off the podcast now. Just give us a quick... because Phantom of the Paradise is interesting because it's unlike anything that not only Brian De Palma's done, but unlike anything that most directors have ever done.
Yeah, no, I hate that.
I think it kind of sits in... When we did the Ken Russell one last year, and we did Tommy, and we looked at the Odyssode as well, I kind of... You know, it's probably closer in thematically to those sort of things than anything else we've ever discussed.
There was a musical episode in The Offing, I think.
It's hard to describe. It does have one scene of bad dancing, which takes us back to Scarface. You got Jessica Harper who can't dance for shit.
Bad dancing. Maybe that is a
in her right near the beginning when she's being auditioned.
No, I remember
for the chorus line, and she can't really dance very well.
Underlying theme in De Palma films.
Beautiful women who can't dance.
Yeah, there probably is a bit of that in The Promising and Carrie as well.
Yeah, quite possibly.
And it came interestingly between Sisters and Obsession. So he's jumping all over the place stylistically there, isn't he? In the early 70s.
No, I think he's brilliantly diverse, but he doesn't always quite hit the mark. I mean, Carrie's my favourite.
Carrie's a beautiful film. I think one of the things that struck me about that when I was watching it recently was how impressive the final kind of half hour of that film is, you know, and the moment when just after she's been drenched in the pig's blood, and the moment when the lights, everything turns to red.
Yeah,
there's just like you get a great clunking fist in your gut at that point, because now you're gonna fucking get it, you bastards, you know? And it's brilliant, but so sad as well, because Carrie is a beautiful, harmless, you know, girl, and they make her into something that she never wanted to be. And anyway, whole other podcast there. Yeah. That's when we do our Stephen King 7-hour special, folks.
Oh yeah, wonderful. So,
yep.
And that's just where we read The Stand out aloud, isn't it?
Yes, yes, absolutely. So,
but in preparation, we all have to read his entire back catalogue. So it might take a while.
Just really, really quickly, I can't remember Sissy Spacek. Obviously played Carrie in Carrie. I think she did wardrobe and set design on Phantom of the Paradise.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah,
I've actually got quite a soft spot for The Fury as well. It was one of the first films that
ripped Fury. Well, you see, this is it. This is the difficulty in doing one on De Palma, because you're going to want to reference everything eventually.
It's a good book and a good film. You did a good job of adapting it.
Yeah.
Anyway,
so that's a good final note to end on, is it? A random thought out of nowhere.
Yeah, absolutely. So it just remains for me to give out the contact details for anybody who really thinks it's a good idea to try and engage with us on any level. And so you can reach us on opticnerds@hotmail.co.uk or follow us on Optic Nerds. Is there any underscore in the at Optic Nerds?
We're just at, I think we're at the Optic Nerds.
At the Optic Nerds. Don't follow Optic Nerds. It's to do with ophthalmology or something.
Yeah. Hashtag film.
Yep. So without further ado, Pete, thank you for helping me get through this one.
That's a pleasure.
Mark, your support was just phenomenal. And...
Well, Phil, you've been a pillar of strength.
It's time for me to remove my hat, sir.
And we will join you. You will join us, rather, next time for the. Actually, we don't know what we're doing. What we're doing next. So there's a good reason to follow us on Twitter or like us on Facebook. How do they like us on Facebook? What's the?
I think they need the interweb for that.
Yeah, yeah.
Access your computer machine and type in the Optic Nerds to Facebook.
Yes, there you go. So goodbye and sweet dreams until next time.
Goodbye.
See you.